Walking into the empty second floor of the former Nashawena Mill, voices take on an echo. The huge room is a typical mill space, about 300 feet long, with high ceilings, oversized windows, and rows of evenly spaced columns. The other floors house a clothing manufacturer and studio space for painters and sculptors. Aside from a rolling cart that occasionally rumbles by overhead, this second floor space is silent. But a century ago, it would have clattered with the din of power looms crowding the room from one end to the other. New Bedford no longer has any working looms, but further north in Lowell, 80 power looms at the Boot Mills Museum still produce fabric each day. And this deafening sound is what New Bedford's mill workers would have heard day in and day out.
With machinery running, it would have been loud, it would have been hot, it would have been dusty.
That's Ann Lauro, historic preservation planner for the city of New Bedford.
There were cotton bits flying everywhere. There'd be, you know, cotton remnants all over the floors and full of people because there were three shifts running 24/7.
These mills attracted mainly young women eager to escape the drudgery of rural life in early America. Many were French Canadians from Quebec or immigrants from Ireland, England, Greece, or Poland.
They felt comfortable. There were other people who spoke their language. You know, they came here to New Bedford and they built their families and generations after them or what still exists here in New Bedford.
In the mid-1800s, cities like Lowell already had a thriving textile industry, but New Bedford was still riding high as the whaling capital of the world. Then in 1858, the first oil well was drilled in Pennsylvania and whaling was doomed. The whaling merchants who reaped huge profits needed new places to invest their money and decided to build textile mills in New Bedford.
The immigrant population in the city just exploded.
New Bedford wasn't a random choice. These were savvy businessmen who knew the city was ideally positioned to enter the textile trade. It had an impressive port and easy access to rail transportation. And the influx of young women who were needed to operate the mills kept right on coming.
This part of the city that we're in right now, what we call the North End, was in 1870, 1880, was essentially farmland, stone walls and woods and meadows. And when the mills were established in this section of the city, that's when the neighborhoods became established.
Parents taught their children the millworking trade, and most children started working in the mills by age 10 or 11. Men worked here, too, mostly to repair and maintain the complex machinery. During New Bedford's textile heyday, the mills employed more than 41,000 workers. 10-hour days were the norm for full-time workers, 8 hours for part-timers. The work was monotonous and grinding, but the mill workers showed up day after day because if they didn't, there were many others eager to take their jobs. Joe Thomas is a South Coast historian and publisher.
At one time in New Bedford, we had the highest percentage of women workers in the country. And that was early on. That was right around World War I.
Photos from the early 1900s show mill workers posed in front of their machines. The women wear floor-length skirts with their long hair bunched up over their heads. It's not hard to imagine how easily hair or skirts could get caught up in the gears, levers, or belts of the machines. But there was little, if any, concern for worker safety in the mills, and many women and children suffered horrible accidents as a result. Catherine McLaughlin's father was a loom fixer. Each morning he'd leave their New Bedford home and head to the mills to repair and maintain the long rows of looms.
I think he started when he was 13 or 14. Let's see, he was born in 1912. And they laid him off when he was 55 with no severance pay, not a penny. He was a loom fixer. Where do you go?
She feels a lot of bitterness about the way her father and many of the other mill workers were treated.
There was no safety net. None. Once the mill closed down, people, thousands of people, saying, what are we going to do? Yeah, and there was no help for them.
With so many mills in so many cities, the market became glutted and prices began to plummet. Production costs also were becoming much lower in the South. In 1928, with the industry close to collapse, most New Bedford textile workers went on strike. Here's historian Joe Thomas again.
The workers weren't striking to get something, they were striking to prevent something.
Specifically, a 10% pay cut proposed by the owners.
When they settled for a 5% cut. But then the owners speeded up the machines. So if you were a weaver, or you know, you tended so many looms, they gave you more looms to tend, and they sped up the speed of the looms. So the quality would deteriorate, and the conditions still were bad.
By then, the mill owners were doing anything they could to survive.
Ultimately, the industry was doomed. The strike was just a harbinger of what was to come. The strike was a symptom of what was going on. People had no money, and they were making things that they couldn't consume.
The year after the strike came the Great Depression of 1929.
All the mills, almost all of them, just collapsed, and they didn't move anywhere. A lot of them did move south, but most of them went bankrupt.
By the 1930s, the days of New Bedford as a 24/7 mill town with thousands of workers churning out fabric to meet an insatiable demand were effectively over. The textile industry was gone, but during and after World War II, other industries came in to occupy all the newly empty mill space. Today, efforts are underway to save some of these old structures and transform them into something new and different.